state, which is already in MHD turbulent equilibrium. We are going to find as one of our conclusions that the boundary conditions may be crucial in the development of a dynamo. I'll go through 5 points, review the classical linear theory of turbulent dynamos. I'll try to mention a few attempts in the past to discuss the question of the nonlinear saturation of one of the parameters that enters the linear theory. Then I'll talk about a new subject, which is that we believe that the saturation of alpha is strongly connected with the conservation of magnetic helicity. There is therefore a constraint from that, which we are seeing in the numerical simulations. Then I'll talk about some recent work on nonlinear saturation and make some conclusions. Okay, to review the classical linear theory, I think this is very familiar to many of you. We're going to use not only the induction equation, but also the momentum equation in this form. It's essential to use them both together to get a nonlinear understanding of the problem. Here, B is in the units of 1 over the square root of 4 pi rho, so it has the units of velocity. Now, turbulence has been studied and discussed here in several different contexts, but let me put up a turbulent spectrum of incompressible isotropic turbulence, which emerges from a variety of different calculations. This is meant to be the final state of stirred incompressible conducting fluid, where the stirring scale is L0. K0, therefore, is referred to as 1 over L0. If I stir the turbulence with a forcing term, which I will discuss, typically one gets a peak in the kinetic energy at about L0, and the magnetic energy comes into equipartition at short wavelengths, or large K, due to the fact that the eddy turnover time is very fast and will bring the turbulence into equipartition. Later, I will make the assumption, which may be debatable, that the equipartition range is actually dominated by wave-like motions. However, because the stirring is by forcing, the magnetic energy in this range, although it is trying to come up to the kinetic energy, doesn't quite make it. It is not in equipartition. And I think that is a key point in the operation of dynamos. To go on with the linear theory, the theory has been worked out very carefully for the very specific case where L0 is much smaller than the size of the system. And therefore, one can assume an intermediate scale over which one can average and get an equation of evolution for the field, which is the average or mean field. This should be a vector symbol. It looks very much like this, but we see terms here which represent the curl of V bar cross B bar, the average field across with the average velocity, something you would expect in an averaging process here, and a new term which is called the turbulent EMF. And this turbulent EMF represents the small scale velocity crossed with a small scale B field, and thereby producing an effective electric field whose curl gives dB dt, dB bar dt. And we keep in here the dissipative term, where lambda is the magnetic diffusivity. In Moffat's book, you find a proof that near homogeneity and isotropy gives you the result that B cross B average is something proportional to B bar itself minus a term which is proportional to the current associated with B bar. And these two coefficients, alpha and beta, are then the subject of discussion in developing this theory further. Parker, in his famous 1955 paper, showed that if there is what he calls cyclonic or helical convection in the system, alpha is not zero. And that was a very important step forward at the time. Steenbeck et al. Then derived this formula for alpha under certain conditions, where V now, again, is the small scale velocity. Here is the vorticity, so it is what we might call the helicity of the flow, representing the correlation of the vorticity and the velocity. In other words, if the velocity is this way and the vorticity is also that way, this number would be positive, otherwise negative. An important concept here is the correlation time of the turbulence, which in the classical work is rather vaguely defined. I'm going to come back to a discussion of that. Pouquet et al., in a paper in 1976, coming at this problem from a completely different point of view, discovered that there is another term here which is proportional to the small-scale magnetic field times the small-scale current. And it has a similar form to the other one. It happens to have the opposite sign. So if one makes a kinematic assumption, namely that these velocity and magnetic fields are given, one can then put these numbers into this formula, into this equation, and you get an equation for B bar, which looks like this, and you see that it is linear in B bar if you suppress any dependence of alpha and beta on the magnitude of B bar. It's a linear equation which has been solved in many different contexts, and of course it is oversimplified because you don't expect alpha and beta to be constant. There are many questions about the velocity profile, etc., etc. But the application to our galaxy in particular has been worked out in different ways. In the book by Ruzmaikin, you will find solutions which yield the form and the growth rate of B bar. That is, you have an eigenvalue problem for this linear equation, and you can find the growth rate corresponding to the eigenvalue here. And because it is a linear equation, of course, it cannot give you the magnitude of B bar. The most that those solutions can tell you is the form of the fastest growing mode. And when you do that for what is known about the galaxy, for instance, the V bar being a rotation of the galaxy, and estimates for alpha and beta, the solutions seem to agree quite well with the observations. But keep in mind, these are just solutions for the fastest growing mode, and they do not tell you about the nonlinear evolution. Questions at that point? Sorry? I should have. Beta is here. I didn't define it. It's the turbulent diffusivity, because when you curl this again, if beta is constant, you get a del squared B bar, which acts in the same sense as lambda. Thank you, Ray. Any other point? I wouldn't characterize it as a closure. I would calculate it, I would characterize it as a two-scale approach to an equation that is linear in B. You're averaging over the small scale. Okay, maybe that's the proper terminology.
Your question is, where are the higher derivatives? I would agree with you. There is a closure implied there. Please consult Moffat's book for further details.
Okay. Yes? Okay. I am. What? No, I'm not going. I'll explain why I'm going to concentrate on alpha, which itself is a difficult problem. This is an alpha topic. That's right. Okay, as I said, alpha is a number which could be a function of B bar itself. And it seems reasonable that as B bar grows from some small value, excuse me, that it will react back on the velocity, small scale velocity and small scale magnetic field, and hence affect the values of alpha and beta. So we need to know at what value of B bar, let's call it B bar quick, this saturation or back reaction becomes important. And what I'm going to do here is focus on alpha alone. There is a student at Harvard who is working on beta. It turned out to be extraordinarily complicated, and I wish I had something to say, but I can't. Okay, the simple estimate that you find in the literature is very, very simple indeed. Probably the turbulence will saturate, or at least the alpha effect will saturate, when the mean magnetic field is equal to the speed of the turbulence. Remember the mean magnetic field, all magnetic fields here are in velocity units. And that was where the matter had stood for a while. People who do simulate the galactic dynamo have incorporated that into their models. And everything seemed to work reasonably well. But in 1992, Weinstein and Cattaneo, in a sort of a qualitative physical argument, pointed out that the critical value should be not V0, but the magnetic Reynolds number to the minus 1/2 times V0. And I'm not going to discuss in detail their argument, which is too complicated to describe here, but instead come to another description which gives the same result. But the thing that threw the community into concern was that if you take that literally for the galaxy, because the magnetic Reynolds number is very high, would give a critical value of the order of 10 to the minus 8 V0. The actual observations of the magnetic field in the galaxy say that the present value of B bar in the galaxy is equal to V0, not 10 to the minus 8 of it. So if this were true, the dynamo theory of the galactic field would certainly not work. Now, what's really important is that a simulation by Cattaneo and Hughes, which appeared in the literature, supports this formula. That is to say, for a given Reynolds number, they performed a simulation with periodic boundary conditions in which they found that the alpha saturated at a critical magnetic field which scaled with V0 in this way. And at the discussion of this issue a couple of weeks ago right here at the Institute, David Hughes was here, and he presented further information which showed that the RM to the minus 1/2 scaling is also correct. In other words, he demonstrated the validity of this formula. So, if this is all correct and we have not made any mistakes, the dynamo cannot work for the galaxy, at least in the form that it has been discussed. just to review this, present value of the magnetic field, mean magnetic field in the galaxy is of the order of 3 microgauss. The observed value of V0 is of the order of 10 kilometers per second. If you do the trick with the square root of 4 pi rho, those two things are equal. B bar equals V0. Obviously, it should be less than B bar crit if the theory is to work. So if Einstein and Catania are correct, dynamo action can't work. Yes. There are a number of reasons. Probably the most important is the only other suggestion that has been made is that the field that we observed is primordial or fossil. And Parker has argued that the beta term, which is a turbulent diffusivity, is so large that such a fossil field would be removed in approximately 3 × 10⁸ years, less than approximately 1 rotation time. And we have to, obviously you don't agree with that. So there is some disagreement on this point, probably because the behavior of beta is under dispute. Okay? That's probably the main reason. The other reason is that the dynamo calculations reveal very good, they correspond to what we see. The fastest growth mode. Right. 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 I believe that a calculation which is owing to Zeldovich in the 70s, I believe, has been misinterpreted, and that simply isn't true. What happens actually is that the small-scale field comes to equipartition with the velocity field. Period. Small-scale field. It isn't actually. The Catania thing, let me not focus so much on Catania because there's an independent argument which is very interesting that goes back to Zeldovich, and I will try to give that argument which also favors that result. Yeah, that's right. So that is, in fact, my next subject. You all know about magnetic helicity, right? Well, some of us know some of the time. Magnetic helicity is a curious beast, which is the inner product of the vector potential and the magnetic field, A dot B. And just from the induction equation alone, you can prove a conservation law, which looks like this. This is just manipulating the induction equation. Here, H is a bilinear function of the magnetic field and the electric field. For what I need to say here, we don't need to know anything about it except that this term is a divergence. This term, E dot B, nothing special about it except that in ideal MHD, it's zero because E is V cross B. Therefore, in ideal MHD, you have a conservation law of this quantity A dot B. What does it mean? As Moffat showed, it means that the linkage of lines of force is preserved. That is to say, the volume integral of A dot B represents the linkage of all the lines of force in the region. And in ideal MHD, you can sort of visualize that that is a constant of the motion, because to break the linkage of the lines of force, material particles would have to move through each other because the field is glued to the matter. Okay, in 1985, our chairman, Moffat, showed that there is a constraint imposed by the fact that E dot B bar, I'm sorry, I should have said E bar dot B bar,
E bar being this turbulent EMF that I mentioned before, dotted into B bar, can be calculated simply in terms of alpha and beta. And if the Reynolds number is very large, so that eta is very small, you have something that you could plug in here that is the right-hand side of the Solicity conservation law. So they use, there is perhaps some constraint from the fact that there is Solicity conservation. Well, I'm not going to go through their argument, but rather a somewhat more detailed argument that Eric Blackman and I have presented and is coming out in APJ. And I won't go through these calculations, just to say that let us consider the quantity E dot B, average it over the system, and not over the system, sorry, over a box which is smaller than the system, and do that in two different ways. One of them related to this, the other one related to just taking the point values of E and B and working out the result. What you find is two expressions for the same thing. One of the terms cancels from both sides, and you end up with an expression that looks like this. This part, alpha B bar squared minus beta B bar dot del cross B bar on one side, and on the other side, something that represents the contribution of eta J dot B, small scale average of J dot B. Let me say that again, the average of the small scale J dot B. Okay? This is just pure mathematical manipulation. Notice, however, that there is another term here, E dot B, that just comes mathematically out of looking at this equation. And my contention is that several people who have looked at this, including Brusinoff and Diamond, Bhattacharjee and Yuan, and Zayhoffer, have in various ways, I think, misconstrued or overlooked this term. Now, let's get back to this equation. You will notice the super zeros and super twos here. They relate to the fact that Eric and I found in a paper that was published recently in the Astrophysical Journal that one has to be very careful with considering the ordering of these quantities in terms of the power of B bar that is involved. And I'll explain that a little more when I come to our calculation of alpha in terms of a power series in B bar. But basically, if you're not careful, you can write equations like this, which, if interpreted properly in terms of a power series, really are telling you that zero equals zero, and that some of the work in the literature has stumbled on that point. So what I mean here is the following thing. I'll try to say it very carefully, that here we have the magnitude of B bar squared, which is a finite number, and what we have to put in front of it is the zeroth order approximation to alpha without back reaction. Ditto here with beta zero and so forth. Whereas on the right-hand side, we have to consider not the actual value of B dot del cross B, small scale, and so forth, but the second order approximation, for example, B1 dot del cross B1, B0 dot del cross B2, etc., etc. And I'll try to explain that later. Yes. No. On the contrary, it is unspecified entirely. So I'll come to that when I discuss the latest work on nonlinear saturation. Yes, the fluctuations are all average to zero. Yes. Yes. Okay, now, so here is a peculiar-looking formula which follows from this, and which in turn follows just from the induction equation. It's rather strange, and I invite comments at the appropriate time. as to what it means. I will give my own interpretation, but others may differ.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, I'm sorry. Please excuse me. I forgot to mention. Remember way back there was a V bar? I set that equal to zero. This term is not controversial in the community, so it's just E alpha that I'm talking about now. Does it?
But if you're talking about saturation.
Yeah. Yes.
The point was, Peter says that in simulations that he's done, the saturation occurred because V bar was affected by the back reaction, and I haven't even discussed V bar. That shows my prejudice. I'm considering mostly the galactic problem, where the V bar is so big that V can't do anything to it. So thank you for pointing out that omission. Okay, so when you you can apply this in two different situations, and let's see what the implications are. Let's suppose that we're doing a simulation with periodic boundary conditions, and we assume a steady state. V bar, we assume, is a constant in the box, so the curl of V bar is zero. We then look at this term, and we see that you can prove that it, in turn, obeys a relation like this one. Namely, it is basically the divergence of a four divergence of helicity, including a time dependence and a spatial dependence. And this quantity, we say, is zero because this is a steady state. This disappears because the average of a divergence with periodic boundary conditions is zero. The conclusion, therefore, manipulating this equation, is, just looking at all these terms, that alpha 0, V bar squared, has to be less than or equal, or it's equal to this, sorry, equal to this number, and that has to be less than or equal in the formalism that I described, where things are described in terms of a power series, has to be less than lambda times B times the current average, magnitude here. And I think I made a mistake. I think this should definitely have an average value here. I'm sorry.
What?
Beta was thrown out because del cross B bar is zero.
in a simulation in a box, yeah. Right. Right. The second order in the V bar.
They have to be in order to get the ordering correctly on both sides.
Yes, there is an expansion parameter which I'll describe. I haven't described any of that yet. This is just, I'm now talking, if you remember, I was going to talk about the constraints on alpha imposed by helicity conservation. And there's a large literature on this, which I'm trying to explicate at this point. But if you wish, you can forget about these things at the detail at this point. I will come back to that. Sorry. What? No, doesn't depend on that. Well, I think, no, this is a second order term in B bar, this is a second order term in B bar. You divide them, you get something which is zero order in B bar. What? Oh, right. I don't have to consider them because this equation, by luck, just has a B bar squared on this side. So higher order terms are irrelevant. They would go away at the second order. I'm only considering this equation order by order to be systematic. Okay, can we defer discussion at this point to a later point in the discussion? I'm afraid I'm running
15 minutes ago. Okay. Anyway, let me get to the bottom line. If you replace this formula by a very simple estimate, namely lambda times B0 squared, B0 now referring to the outer scale, L0 to the minus 1 for the curl, and finagle a little bit, you see that this is Rm to the minus 1 times this little B0 over big over B bar squared. Now, alpha 0 can be normally estimated to be of the order of V0, which is the velocity at the outer scale. It has the units of velocity, and it is, in fact, expected to be of that order. The reduction factor, therefore, is this number. Therefore, this number becomes significant as a depression of the value of alpha when B bar is equal to this number, which is exactly what Weinstein and Cattaneo argued. Their argument was based on a completely different physical argument. So it's interesting that it comes out this way. Okay, so we're still stuck in the sense that the classical theory cannot explain the field of the galaxy. Sorry, I want to make one more point about this. I want to interpret this equation, and this is an important point. Let me try to interpret, let's see, which one? Let's try this one. What this represents, in particular, let's just focus on the alpha term. This represents the creation of magnetic helicity in the system by the alpha effect. This is the rate of creation of magnetic helicity by the alpha effect. And when you look at this term, you see that this is the destruction of small-scale helicity by dissipation, by ohmic losses. When you look at this term, as I showed here, it represents either the accumulation of helicity in the system of small scale or the escape of helicity out of the boundary. That's what this thing is saying, that the total helicity everywhere in the system must remain constant except for this dissipation term. So anything produced by the alpha effect either has to be dissipated at small scales or can escape from the system. And this interpretation is inspired by the paper of Pouquet, which discusses this very carefully, the flow of helicity in a dynamo. So that is my interpretation. The positive, let us say the helicity created at large scale happens to be positive, and it must be balanced by negative helicity created at small scale, which must be dissipated as it can escape through the boundaries. And as Rm goes to infinity, this severely constrains alpha in a closed system. So try to visualize it this way. You're grinding away with the alpha effect. You're producing large-scale magnetic helicity. To balance that, to conserve helicity, you are also producing helicity with opposite sign at the small scale. If it cannot escape through the boundary, it must dissipate. But it can't dissipate because the Reynolds number is high. That is the physics behind this upper limit here. Okay, second application, open boundary conditions, the helicity can escape through the boundary. Therefore, this restriction vanishes. That's the bottom line. Sorry, H is this bilinear combination of field strengths and so forth. It's basically E cross A. But it doesn't really matter at this point. Just to make the point that helicity can't escape. So we need more work on alpha in open systems. And I think we'll hear more about that. Okay, now I'm switching gears. I'll go through this very quickly. That before considering all of this, Eric and I were interested in working on this problem of nonlinear saturation, and we discovered to our amazement something that I had not found in the literature, namely that one can make a power series expansion for alpha in terms of B bar, hence my talking about the alpha to various orders and so on. You have to use, we use a simple case where the underlying turbulence is homogeneous isotropic incompressible. And I want to stress here, very important, the unperturbed state is this forced MHD turbulence, which is in a steady state. So the concept here, I think, is different from what has been used in the literature. Namely, you start with forced MHD turbulence in a steady state, and then you imagine a series of experimenters who report from their various computers, I am using B bar equals 0.01. No, I'm using 0.03, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't matter what the units are. I'm just saying, at this point, small, larger, largest, and so forth. And they report different values for alpha. And the reason they are reporting it is, if you look at the details here, is that you have a turbulent spectrum, chaos, but each eddy is being affected by the imposed B bar. And in particular, you can see that B bar is going to affect the individual velocities and change those velocities slightly from what they would have been if B bar were not present. That is going to affect alpha. So, yes, right. The small, oh, sorry, thank you, Russell. I'm sorry, let me stress once again that we are assuming that the guy who walked in the front door came in with one or more realizations of a field with B bar equals zero, whose statistics we know completely, by once and for all. Pardon me? Please excuse me, I couldn't hear you. Yeah. Right. As a result of measures on this turbulent field that he has produced with whatever forcing he chooses, I am given every available statistic of V0 and B0. Okay? So indeed, none of this makes any sense unless we have somebody willing to simulate this case with B bar equals zero. When you finish doing that, I'm going to perturb it with B bar. Okay? Maybe okay. It is a different approach than before. Well, I won't go into a lot of mathematics and so forth, except to point out the weak points. I will stress the weak points in the calculation. First of all, we take nu, the viscosity equal to lambda, for simplicity. That is often done in the literature. We know it's crazy because, in fact, nu is vastly greater than lambda in many cases. So this has limited validity. It turned out that to solve this problem, it's very convenient to go to L sets of variables. I don't know why, but they are the natural variables for the system. What I do is then expand the actual value of the L sets of variable. There are two of them, plus and minus, which are related to B and B, power series in B bar. And I truncate that, or I recapitulate that in a very simple way. There is the zero order state, which I'm perturbing, and there's everything else. And Hong Sang Chu, who is here today, actually did this thing with an infinite series, and I was working on it simultaneously, getting nowhere. We looked at his series, and we realized that it is an analytic function. So we can actually do the whole thing in terms of just one perturbation variable. This includes all orders. I won't go through all of this except to say that when you formulate the problem, you find nonlinear terms in the perturbation. Yes? It's just... it turns out to be B bar over V naught. At the end of the calculation, that's what it is, yeah. The nonlinear terms are of order one. And I shamelessly admit that we omitted them. I see some people shaking their heads negatively, others saying, you poor guy. Okay, Fourier transform, and the bottom line is to get this correlation, which is, of course, a vector quantity, you need something that looks like this. In terms of the quantity z plus and z minus, it's just this expression. And because you're working with Fourier transforms, you need a correlation of these Fourier transformed functions here. And I just want to admit another thing, which is very important. This expression is very standard. It comes from isotropy. This expression is standard also in a situation like this. This is something that we introduce, which is intuitive and cannot be defended at this time. It is to say that the correlation between modes of K are due to nonlinear mode-mode interactions. They have a finite correlation time, which is gamma to the minus 1. Result, plug that into the expression, and you get an expression for alpha. Okay, and I'll just explain what that is and what the limits of it mean, hopefully. How much time do I have, Mike? Thank you. I think I can finish. Oh my God. Okay. In the previous formula, which you've already forgotten, there was an H roof, which is a Fourier transform. The integral over all a K of that is the thing that we saw before from the Fourier calculation. And the function that is represented there has this peculiar form, which has appeared in the literature before in a different context. You can show that alpha for all values of B is less than alpha 0, the zeroth order approximation, and that in general, if the spectrum is peaked at some wave number k star, alpha takes this form. It looks very much like the original zero order approximation. There is this function of two variables here, where beta is indeed B bar over the velocity at the outer scale, and the other thing is a magnetic Reynolds number. And the key result of all of this is that this function of Rm and beta has two terms. One of them goes to zero as Rm goes to infinity, as claimed by Cattaneo and Weinstein. The other one doesn't. It just goes to f of beta. And let me show a curve of f of beta. F of beta goes from 1/3 to 0 as the argument goes through 1, it's 0.2, and so forth. It goes to 0 like 1 over x squared. As I said, the result, strangely enough, is an analytic function which you can look up. Final conclusions here are, first of all, that to explain the galactic dynamo by this theory would require that the critical value in the theory is greater than the observed value, and that would be okay, but Cattaneo and Hughes find that the critical value is very small, and that wouldn't, and helicity conservation agrees with their result, but that is only for periodic boundary conditions. Open boundary conditions would permit helicity to escape, hence no limit on alpha. We study the no boundary case, and we find that B crit twiddles V0, and therefore it should work, or at least it's not ruled out at the present time. Thank you. Yes.
On the one hand, you said, well, I've ignored the fact that it's big in the galaxy. That's what I heard you say. I would think you'd want to track it all the way through this formulation, and hopefully it would average out or something.
Yeah. No, I don't think it would average out. I think qualitatively we realize that the observed magnetic field of the galaxy, never mind theory, is such that it would change V bar by less than 1%. Yeah, I'm just talking about the back reaction on V bar, which is what we're interested in. Look, I agree with you in principle, And that could be done, yes. What terms am I discarding? Okay. It would manifest itself in the production of a large-scale magnetic field at a scale which is larger than the input turbulence scale. So some of us refer to that as an inverse cascade.
I think we've asked for all the questions. Thank you very much.
Sure.